Our next story is from W. Kamau Bell. He's a comedian and a father. And recently, Kamau's been planning for a conversation he really does not want to have with his children, one that is familiar to Black parents everywhere in America. Act two, if you see racism, say racism. Here's Kamau.
I talk about race and racism in my act a lot. Some would say too much. It was how I was raised. Some families have hardware stores. My family has thinking about racism. So it's no surprise to me that after I became a parent, I began to do jokes about race and racism and fatherhood.
And people ask me all the time, like, you're Black, you talk about race a lot, and have you talked to your daughter about the fact that she's Black? And I'm like, no, because she's 3 and a half. I don't want to bum her out yet, you know what I'm saying? Like, being Black is great, but it's like a big responsibility to know that. My mom waited until I was 8 before she told me I was Black. And she did it the right way. One night she's like, tonight for dinner, you can have whatever you want. I was like, yay. And she's like, you can stay up all night and watch TV. I was like, yay. And you're Black. I was like, hold on a second. That explains everything. I thought every day I was just kind of having a shitty day. It's good to know why now. It's good to know there's a historical context for that.
I now have 2 girls, a baby named Juno and an almost 4-year-old named Sammy. My wife, Melissa, is white. And Sammy calls herself Peanut Butter. Juno doesn't say much of anything yet. My wife and I have both put our toes, or at least our older daughter Sammy's toe, in the race pool. But we have not even put the slightest hint of a Sammy toe into the racism pool. Yes, those are separate pools. The race pool is filled with positive stories of Black achievement, African-American role models, books and TV shows featuring diverse characters. Our race pool even has Kwanzaa. But Sammy's racism pool is completely drained with a lock on the gate. And we run past it every day on the way to the race pool. And every day that goes by, I feel guilty. The racism pool is treacherous. It's not fun to swim in. And if you aren't careful, you drown in the sorrow of the Black experience in America. Damn. We live in Berkeley. People have been protesting the police blocks from our house. How do I explain that? This was on my mind recently. How to teach Sammy about racism. When this thing happened, it was January 26th of this year, my birthday. I was having a low-key celebration, just like I like them. I was carrying a children's book I had just bought for Sammy, The Case for Loving, The Fight for Interracial Marriage. Mildred and Richard Loving are the interracial couple responsible for the Supreme Court striking down the laws in 16 states that banned interracial marriage. And if I was going to get into racism with Sammy, then the Loving story, which was about a family like ours, seemed like a great place to start. I was headed to meet up with my wife at the Elmwood Cafe, a restaurant she loves. This was her second time eating there that day, after we'd gone there earlier for breakfast. It's not really my kind of place. It's a little bit too impressed with itself, a little too humble-braggy about its lattes served in bowls. So, I get to the Elmwood Cafe, and I see my wife sitting at one of their sidewalk tables with our baby and 3 other moms and their babies. The 4 moms all look like they would go out for the same casting call. 4 white women, mid-30s, who has recently had a kid, and while exhausted, is doing a great job of keeping it together. My wife introduced me to the group. We made small talk. One of the women asked about the book in my hand, so I turned it over and showed it to her. She nodded at the cover. I didn't get the sense she knew the story. That's when I heard, knock, knock, knock. It was on the cafe's window, coming from inside. I looked up and saw a woman, a server, who clearly worked at the Elmwood Cafe, and she was angry and looking at me. Next, she flicked her head and mouthed something. I didn't know what, but the message was clear. Get! Or maybe it was scram! Seriously, what's the difference? I was flooded with thoughts I could barely process. I was stunned. I was pissed. I wanted to run away. I felt like I might pass out. I was actually strangely embarrassed, as if I had done something wrong. Maybe I shouldn't have been talking to my wife and her friends. Melissa and I might have exchanged words. We might not have. I think I said something to the effect of, a woman told me to get out of here. There were some reallys and a couple of whats. Within seconds, another server came out and pretended to do her job. She didn't have a water jug. She didn't bust any tables. She didn't drop or pick up any checks. She just stalked the area. And by the area, I mean me. Finally, Melissa couldn't take it. This is my husband. Oh, the waitress said, looking at nobody in particular. We thought you were selling something. She thought I was selling something? That's my wife and my daughter, I said. We just ate here earlier today. Oh, we thought you were selling something, she said. Sorry. In Berkeley, selling something is code for homeless. What she was saying was, we thought you were homeless. First of all, I was wearing a knit cap, a hoodie, jeans, and sneakers. I was dressed like Mark Zuckerberg in winter. But I knew the part of me that looked homeless wasn't my clothes. It was my skin. Specifically, how my skin was getting so close to a bunch of white moms and their white babies. But Juno only looks white. She's a double agent. Waitress again. I'm sorry. Me. I bet you're sorry. Okay, I'm gonna take a walk and think about racism. That's actually what I said. I didn't yell it, but I didn't say it into my chest either. Melissa stayed behind to give the waitress a piece of her mind. Then we went home, and Melissa cried. We hugged each other and were preoccupied with it, really bothered, really obsessive, and stuck in it. We knew we had to do something. I blogged about the whole thing and posted a picture of myself wearing exactly what I'd worn when I was at the Elmwood and also holding my book on the Lovings. Within a couple hours, the story had spread around the Bay Area. People online started debating every single point. People debated whether what happened was racist, whether or not I was racist. People blamed me for marrying a white woman. It became the righteous indignation story of the week. It's hard to know what to want after something like this happens. I didn't want an apology from the owner, though we got one. I didn't want the waitress to be fired, though she was. Melissa and I wanted something more substantial. We wanted a public conversation between us and the cafe owner and the employees involved. We wanted the community to show up and talk about their experiences with things like this. We wanted a reckoning. And we found out a lot of people wanted that. So many people wanted to discuss the Elmwood Cafe that our idea to have a public discussion snowballed. So with our daughters in our mind, before I could say Rosa Parks, we had a venue and an event planner, the cafe owner was there, and a full-on panel of vetted academics and activists. There was a detailed itinerary and a moderator.
So I'm sure that many of you have heard the story of the incident that happened on January 26th.
On a Friday in March, Melissa and I sat on a stage at a middle school in a packed auditorium. My main concern was that somehow all the planning and structure was going to lead to an event that was careful, sanitized, and maybe the worst thing, boring. It wasn't, due in large part to two amazing women on the panel, Khadijah Means, who we'll get to in a minute, but first, Nikki Jones.
Okay, I'll put on my professor voice.
Nikki Jones teaches at UC Berkeley. She said something that, for me, made sense of the world. Not just about the small racial injustices that happen in cafes, but the bigger, deadlier ones that are happening all around America. She asked us to think of the world in terms of black space and white space. She credits Elijah Anderson for this theory, but tonight she made it her main point. Nikki says people have ideas about black spaces. It's tied to blackness and poverty and the ghetto. It's impossible to say the word ghetto in America without thinking about black people. See a black man in a suit? Your brain does a calculus. What poor neighborhood did he or his parents rise up out of? Or his parents' parents? It all goes back to the ghetto.
Right, and the ghetto itself is believed to be carried on the bodies, right, on and in black people. Right, and that presents special dilemmas when black people are in white space. And what's white space? Well, just about everywhere else, right?
She says UC Berkeley, where she teaches, white space. Almost all education, public and private, white space. Movie theaters, restaurants, some of my own stand-up shows, I'm looking at you, Spokane, white space. Public radio, white space. And of course, the Elmwood Cafe.
So in these white spaces, black people have a special burden and they face a number of dilemmas. They have to prove that they belong there. The burden is on them to prove that they belong in a particular space. Now let's go back to the incident. Who belongs in that space? What is the presumption about what Kamau is carrying on his body?
Of course, not belonging can work both ways. A white person in a black space lacks a similar trustworthiness. But think of how rare it is that a white person goes to a black space. Like a tourist in another country, you can leave whenever you choose. But the highlight of the night, high school senior Khadijah Means. She's 18 and made a name for herself in the Bay Area as an activist. She's an awesome public speaker who, importantly to me, knows how to open with a joke.
So, number one, I want to say that I've been black all of my life. That's a pretty good amount of motivation for me to be a social justice advocate.
And then she said something that made me take extra notice. She talked about being younger than my daughter Sammy when she learned about race.
I learned about race at a really young age, maybe like 2 or 3. My dad has a really good way of teaching about like fractions. When he would make me toast, he would cut it in half and be like, this is half, this is a fourth. So I learned about race in a kind of similar way, learning that white didn't mean white like paper, but it was a construct. Yeah, I learned that pretty young. That was weird.
My oldest daughter is 4. She has just begun to understand that people are different colors. I can't imagine somehow connecting that to the fact that race itself is a construct. I'm not sure I could define the word construct to another adult, let alone a 4-year-old. Khadijah then closed with a few tips on how we can all be less racist. Like this one.
Focus less on color blindness, because honestly, you're not going to get a gold star for that. Be more color competent. Be more... Thanks.
And this one.
Please don't call people articulate. Don't come up to me after and tell me I'm articulate. Woo! Please do not do that. And there's a whole bunch of reasons why that we don't have time for. But
you might want to grab a pen and some paper, because she's on a roll.
Your mind makes generalizations. That's what it does. It's not bad to do that. It's bad to think that that one generalization is what everyone is. You also have to take a step outside of that and remember that people are individuals. People have different lives. Just because I'm black doesn't mean I act like other black people. Black people built this country, whether you like it or not. Love us, please. Thank you.
I'm not sure how it's ready for her.
I was so impressed by Khadijah. I began to think about her dad, the one who taught her about fractions and race. Khadijah was completely versed in the evils of racism, but she was also idealistic about the future. She understood how well-intended people could do racist things, but how that doesn't always make them bad people. She got the broad strokes and the nuances. And Khadijah also knew how to do something that is absolutely essential to your survival as a black person in America. She saw and identified racism in her everyday life, and she didn't internalize it. But she also didn't ignore it. She just judo flipped it and kept walking. I wanted some advice on how to raise a kid like that. Who was this dad? I imagined him to be a mix of 60s-era Berkeley hippie and hope and change-era Obama.
I don't smile a lot, so I'm not the smiling black man.
Yeah, that's Cliff Means. He's a self-described businessman who means business. I like to imagine that his business card reads on one line, Cliff Means, and under that, business. In fact, when we asked Cliff to do the interview, initially he said, I don't know you, I don't know your audience, so no. So when my producer Robin and I met with Cliff and Khadijah, I knew he was still reluctant, but I wasn't sure what had changed his mind. I had to ask.
Why are you doing this interview then?
Khadijah really wanted me to do this, is the bottom line. Now, had I found out anything too horrific about either one of you, then it probably still would have been no. But I couldn't find anything terrible. Well, I'll tell you one thing that leaned in your favor. I did read something written by you because I was trying to do as much homework as I could because my answer was really no. And your writing had made enough white people angry that I said, okay, maybe he's actually trying to do something.
So it's clear that Cliff is not exactly a why can't we just get along type of guy. And he has very clear thoughts about what should be taught to kids.
How old was Khadijah when you first started explaining race to her?
I would imagine 4 or 5 years old. She was an early talker, and we spent a ton of time together. I asked her, did she want to enter a speech for the Martin Luther King celebration at her school? And we co-wrote a speech that people were very enamored with. And I explained to her that Martin Luther King wasn't killed for I Have a Dream speech,
But once you start talking about getting poor whites and poor blacks together, then he had to go. But my children, I taught you will be going to school, and you will be getting told that there's justice for all. And then when you find out there's not, then you'll be confused. And I don't want my children confused. I want them knowledgeable.
So, and at what age did you get into the history of black people in this country, like, and have to cover things like pre-civil rights movement, like Jim Crow and slavery and things like that?
At five, I taught her about slavery, and I taught it as what it is, that Europe went to war with West Africa for centuries. Kids used to love Native Americans when I was a kid because they fought back. Why didn't black people fought back? Well, they did. And were slaughtered and terrorized and tortured and murdered and raped. I probably left out rape at that age for her. Captured, kidnapped, and brought over Africans to America. And they were here terrorized and murdered. And we go from that stage all the way to being here enslaved.
He taught her that at five. Cliff is clearly not afraid to throw his kids into the deep end of the racism pool and let them learn to swim. This is pretty much the opposite of what I had done so far. How deep did their racism pool get?
She learned things like white officers following the black migration to Northern California to work in the shipping yards, and Southern California with shipyards. Hey, we better bring some racist white cops here to keep these people in line. She learned that there were, you know, black cooks grinding up glass in the kitchen to make sure that white racist, brutal slave master's intestines would bleed and be open, and then he'd be gone. Where's your question? Do you want the church thing brought up at all?
It's fine.
That's Khadija. I don't know what the church thing is, but I could tell it was one of those family stories. Khadija let my producer Robin and I in on it.
After my dad told me about racism, I distinctly remember, like, being angry with white people. Like, how dare you enslave my people? And so we were at church one day, and...
It wasn't actually at church. It was a church function. It was in the church. It was a church function held after.
So I guess I went up onto the pulpit and asked for the mic. And I told the entire congregation that black people and white people should not be together. And that was my synthesis of, like, racism in America and slavery that I had come up with throughout the week after my dad told me about racism.
You're saying you became a five-year-old segregationist?
I did.
In my house, we can't have a five-year-old segregationist. I mean, don't get me wrong. It'd be fun for a bit in a kid say the darndest things kind of way. I ran a version of what Khadija said in church by my wife Melissa as a hypothetical. What would you do if Sammy told you white people and black people can't be together? It would be an immediate investigation. Melissa would ask, what makes you say that? Why do you think they can't be together? And yes, okay, white people did hurt your people, but also mommy and daddy are together. And that's good, isn't it? It would be a conversation with me. It would be a conversation with Sammy, every day, all the time. I asked Cliff how he felt about Khadija's speech at church.
I was like, well, she learned what she learned. That's probably a healthy reaction for having learned what she learned this week. I think the audience was a little surprised.
Was there a white person in her life that you felt like, uh-oh, if she thinks that about all white people, then she's going to hate this one white person who's actually, you know, a nice person?
I don't know. Absolutely not. I'm not concerned about the white man in America. I think he's doing very well, and I had no concern, or do I now have any concern for anyone's feelings or whatever else being hurt by a five-year-old. Maybe I could start a conversation with them. They can think about some of the things that they enjoy that no one else enjoys in this country. So, no.
Cliff is not an easy person, but then why should he be easy? Cliff is the type of person who keeps the rest of us a little more honest. I want more Cliff in my life. Khadija told me that even with her candid, unfiltered upbringing, she could tell, early on, the difference between white oppression and the white people in her life. But to be able to do that, she had to learn about it and get angry. I get that. When I first began to really understand the violence of racism, I was angry. It makes sense to be angry. The anger helps you push back against the injustice. Anger's not the goal, it's the fuel. Even so, sometimes I feel like I have too much anger. There are black people in America dying from racism. Bad treatment at a fancy coffee shop is the softest and easiest part of racism. There were times during this whole thing I felt like I should just drop it. Cliff and I talked about that too.
Being told to leave a cafe on College Avenue, that's not a big deal on a basic level, but I knew that you can't just keep letting your boundary get pushed.
Mm-hmm. Oh man, I don't let anything go. I don't let anything go. Don't shake my hand like you're black or something. You shake my hand like a white man. You shake my hand like you shake my... You don't relate to me.
Don't let anything go. I feel like it's the message of the day. That's what I feel, but I never put it in those words. Those are the words I was looking for. Don't let anything go.
Racism is real and happening right now, every day. That means that every day I have an opportunity to teach my daughters about racism. So this is to you, Sammy and Juno. I promise you, from now on, I'm not going to let it go. The stakes are too high.
W. Kamau Bell is a comedian in Berkeley. You can hear him on his podcast, Denzel Washington is the Greatest Actor of All Time, period. Or find a list of his upcoming shows on his website, WKamauBell.com. That's WKamauBell.com.